Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, gold hits a new record high. What's driving the price and how do you get involved? Energy bills are back on the rise. Should you fix now before the hike comes in? Also today, we bust some myths on inherited state pensions and ask if annuity deals have peaked. Plus, we take a look at some juicy Ask the Expert reader questions. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, this week gold hit a new record price, soaring above $2,500 an ounce. It may look pretty, but the precious metal generates no income and prices can be volatile. So what's the appeal? What is driving the gold bugs, Tanya? What is happening to gold?
There are lots of things that can drive the gold price, but there's really just one that's very dominant at the moment, and it's the one that often holds a sway, which is what inflation is like in the US and what people expect the US Federal Reserve to do in response. Inflation in the US is down to 2.9%. The expectation is that the Federal Reserve is going to start a cycle of rate cutting. It's almost nailed on that will start at its September meeting. I think that it's really because there's a bit of a fear of a recession in the US. Some people have argued that the Federal Reserve has left it too late to do this. But either way, it does seem that they're going to get stuck in. This always has a big impact on the gold price because it's a hedge against inflation. This is why it's looking more attractive at the moment. But there are many other factors that can also come into play with gold, and that these are things you have to be aware of if you're going to invest in it, because it can be very volatile.
How do you invest in gold, Tanya? I have images of bars hidden. Didn't you cover a story once about some chap that, yeah, Lee's nodding here, that hid gold bars in his estate grounds? That's the sort of gold investing that I'm thinking about here, but I imagine it's a little bit more sensible than that.
You won't be surprised here. That's rather frowned upon. I think
is it? I'd love to have an estate large enough to be hiding my gold bars, Tanya.
I think that you can keep gold at home, but you have to have security in place and insurance to cover it. And most people, if they invest in physical gold, they will keep it in a vault and make sure it's all above board. There are various ways to do it. You can simply buy gold mining shares. If you want to do it that way, they can be very volatile, though. A lot of people do it with exchange-traded commodities, which are quite cheap and easy to buy. It's quite a good way to get exposure. And they're backed by physical holdings of gold, which is important. When you're investing in gold, you want to find out whether they're backed by derivatives, which is not actually physical gold, all the actual stuff being stored somewhere. That's not to say that experienced investors, you know, shouldn't think about investing in the kind of ETFs that are based on derivatives, but you need to know what you're doing. You can also look at funds, lots of multi-asset funds, especially the ones that are aiming for a sort of safer preservation of capital type approach to investing, will have gold, is a safe haven play, and it moves in usually in a different direction from all the other assets in a multi-asset portfolio. So it's a good balance. In the piece we did this week about the new gold price record, there's a couple of fund recommendations in that. And one is HAN ETF, but it's Royal Mint responsibly sourced. And so it's sort of held in the Royal Mint, so you know it's kept somewhere safe. It's responsibly sourced gold. That's the kind of place you might be looking at if you're a everyday investor who just wants a little bit of your portfolio dedicated to gold to diversify it. The person doing the recommendation of these, a couple of funds that you can find on our piece, makes the point that you really shouldn't be putting more than 5 or 10% of your portfolio into gold. I would say 10% would be a bit high. sometimes people move it up and down depending on where they think that the gold price is going to go, but it's notoriously difficult really to predict the gold price. We're in a bit of a phase at the moment where we know pretty much what the Federal Reserve is going to be doing and what impact it's going to have on the gold price. But all sorts of things could happen this autumn, which could suddenly become more dominant than that, because especially since that's now priced in.
Lee, you're nodding along there.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting topic. I mean, gold is one of those hot buzz things that basically you get the gold bugs when it's on a bit of a rise, saying, you know, you told you so, you know, you should always have precious metal in your portfolio. 10% does sound a bit toppy, but, you know, it depends on who you talk to. Actually, when you were talking about that story, burying the gold in the garden, quite hilariously, a few weeks ago, I was away on holiday and I bought my daughter a metal detector. My five-year-old was trying to find a toy in the shop that would keep her occupied. And it was a metal detector that we went for. Now, we haven't found gold. That's not where the story's going.
No.
But I kind of, those kind of stories are kind of the sort of thing I would tell her, you know, or it could be like gold. You know, she's into pirates at the moment. So that's what I think when I think of gold, you know, the actual physical asset. But a lot of people invest just through how Tanya mentioned there, ETCs, for example, rather than the actual physical asset. And it's been on a real tear up, actually, Georgian. And you could argue, would you want to buy at what is currently at the top of the market? Well, we don't know. You know, where is it, the top of the market? You know, when it's at record highs, it's just dipped below 2,500 while we've been talking on this podcast. But it's been over $2,500 this week. And actually, quite interestingly, it means that an average gold bar is now actually $1 million, because the average gold bar is 400 troy ounces, which is, means it's exactly $1 million. So it is $1 million gold bar now. And I was looking through the price history of gold and thinking, well, when has other times when it's peaked and come back down again? So one of them is the pandemic. You're probably not surprised to hear. In July 2020, it just tipped over $2,000. A troy ounce, but that shows you how high it's gone since the pandemic. Really sizable gains. And then I sort of went back in time and thought, well, when was the last peak of that? It really sort of was in the doldrums from sort of 2012 all the way to the pandemic. And there was another sort of spike in 2011 and 2012 when it was around about 1,750. And then before that, you go back in time before that, and it's minuscule, really. I mean, you go back to, you know, around about financial crisis times, 2008, it was under $1,000 an ounce. So that's big gains. I mean, it's up 22% since January. So you can see why the kind of case for gold is there. Lots of people, I'm sure, would have done one out of it. You get people on one side saying, what is gold actually used for? What's its kind of purpose? You know, you can't eat gold. If there's a war going on, you can't eat gold, type of thing. But lots of people see it as that safe haven. You know, lots of geopolitical events going on at the moment across the world, lots of uncertainty. And people see gold as a kind of certain thing. It's been around for a very long time. And people see it and see the value in it. And that's why some very smart, sensible people have it as a few percentage points of their portfolio, because they foresee gold not really sort of crashing. Yes, it's volatile, but it's not volatile. It's not Bitcoin volatile. You know, it doesn't sort of swing that hard. And as I say, it was a decade when it was just in the doldrums. Nothing really happened with it. So if you invested, you know, basically in those times, if you invested in 2012, you would have had to have waited, you know, 7 years basically for that to go back into positive territory on your return. So I would say it's not of the faint hearted, but I could kind of understand it at the moment with lots of uncertainty in the world and why people kind of are driving the price up.
All right, then. Let's move to something else that's going up in price. That is energy bills. We just got the announcement from Ofgem that the price cap that will be coming in October is going up 10%. So the average bill will be taken to £1,717, adding around £12 to the standard fuel bill. Of course, a reminder that that figure, it's only indicative, it's an average, it is not a cap on your total bill. If you use more energy, you are likely to pay more for it. But it comes as Citizens Advice report that one in four people will be forced to turn off their heating and hot water or not turn it on at all because they fear they simply cannot afford to pay any more. Lee, Tanya, goodness me, bit of a blow coming at the same time that pensioners, of course, have their winter fuel payment rug pulled from beneath them, unless you're on pension credits, of course. What is the reason Why are energy bills going up?
It's wholesale energy prices, essentially. Again, you know, geopolitical reasons, things going on around the world, you know, where we get our gas from. And basically the wholesale price has bumped up a little bit. You know, this is, though, I should point out here, nowhere near what we were seeing 2 years ago, when we saw that energy price cap go above £3,500. Absolutely humongous rise in the price cap. And then last winter, it was at £1,923. But there's a big but here. There was so much more support packages around for households. And as you're saying, winter fuel payments, you know, this doesn't look good on the government, because we're now at a position where Ofgem has bumped up the price cap. As you say, it's a typical, it's just a, you know, a kind of barometer, I would say. I wouldn't say this is exactly what you're going to be paying on your energy bill. It just depends on how big your house is and how much energy you use. It's just a rough indication, but it doesn't look good when we're saying that energy bills are going to be going up £149 a year. At the same time, millions of people are getting their winter fuel payments taken away from them. Now, we've had this argument on the podcast already about the fairness of that and whether that's the right move or not. I understand that the government believes there needs to be areas in which cutbacks are needed. Was it the right target? I'm not sure. Now, you can still get this if you qualify for pension credit. The trouble is, there's lots of people out there that are struggling to get by that don't qualify for pension credit and therefore will not qualify for this winter fuel payment for all sorts of different reasons. If you have a loved one, a relative, or if you or someone that's listening to this, I would just go and just check if you're eligible for pension credit or not, if you feel like you're going to struggle this winter with this. But it's not good news seeing this nudge higher, but at least it's not a huge swing. 10%, you know, and what that does to the inflation figures later on in the year, we'll have to wait and see. And then, you know, what knock-on effect that has as well, it's worth pointing out. But yeah, and then you're talking about the Citizens Advice survey here, where actually we were looking at this and saying, that sounds like a really, really high number of people saying you're going to switch the heating off. One in four households are so worried that they're going to be forced to turn off their heating or hot water this winter. I hope it's nowhere near as big as that, George. I'd like to think that no one would need to do that. And it increases to 31%, or say 25% are worried about increases in energy costs. 31% of households with children, 39% of bill payers on the low income are worried about how they're going to switch the heating on this winter. Citizens Advice is saying that it's still helping record numbers of people with energy debt. And that's despite energy prices being lower at the moment than last year. And 1 in 5 million people are in debt with their energy supplier. It doubles the percentage when you look at households with children under 18. All of that is quite worrying. And it comes at a time where, yes, inflation has come right down, but we're still dealing with the after effects of a kind of 20% effective inflation rate over the last couple of years in terms of our household bills, things like the food shop, you know, and other essentials. And it's quite frightening. There are actually some fixed deals out there at the moment that will just about beat this price cap, but it's a bit of a risk. It's a gamble whether or not you want to do it. You know, and you can have a look around. I mean, the cheapest one that we've got listed here is from Outfox the Market, which is saying average yearly bill £1,568. And then there's a few more that are under that £1,717 limit. But some of them come fairly chunky exit fees, for example. So you need to make sure that you take that into consideration. And then we don't know what the price cap's going to be next time around.
What are all the predictions, Lee? Well, looking ahead, I think, provided the latest one, I think they're only out by about £3. Yeah, so they're obviously good ones to read.
Cornwall Insight are quite accurate at this. So taking them as the kind of the oracle of future price cap rises, they're saying essentially it's probably going to be a further modest increase. Price cap changes again in January 2025. And as we sign off, Sam Barker signs off in the story here. Cornwall Insight has correctly predicted the direction of all price cap changes since energy prices became volatile in late 2021. So you probably want to listen to them, and you might want to go and investigate what fixed deals are out there that your provider might be offering at the moment, or other providers. But it's looking like energy bills. And it's just that time of year again where obviously we start switching on the heating way more from October onwards. and it starts to become tricky again, you know, that whole heat or eat argument and all of that.
Daniel, we forget sometimes when the economy, as Lee points out there, is doing better and looks £1,700 compared to the figures that we've seen over the last couple of years is a lot healthier. But actually, we're still dealing with the aftermath of the COVID situation, and people were already struggling even before that.
Yes. And when I write about energy prices, I'm often informed by Age UK, which is very sobering. They send quotes from the front line, basically, from elderly people. And it's not just elderly people. Lee mentioned families there as well. And there's really heart-rending stuff about people spending their day in bed under piles of blankets and too worried to cook. That's why I find really upsetting that they live on sandwiches because they're too worried to turn their cooker on. They don't even want to boil the kettle. They're literally afraid to boil the kettle. It's absolutely desperate stuff. It's going to be particularly hard this year, I think, with the winter fuel payment going and also the cost of living payments that people have been getting in the last few years are all going to go. It may well be that some people aren't aware of that yet and haven't budgeted for it. Not everybody who is in those kind of straits is following the personal finance headlines on this kind of thing. And so they are going to get a shock. My feeling is that there are a lot of wealthy pensioners who did not need the winter fuel payment. And I can understand why it's been taken away from them. I do think, though, that making it pension credit only might be too drastic. Partly because of the people, as Lee said, who are just above it, and also because of all the people who don't apply for it. They're launching a new awareness campaign at the moment, and hopefully it will be successful. But I just wonder if they won't be prevailed upon to suggest something in the budget, some kind of welfare fund or some kind of measures to assist people in the worst situations, rather than just sticking to this hard line, you've got to be on pension credit or it's gone. Politicians have got lots and lots of different levers to pull, and they're, without backing down on what they've already announced, they can announce something that is going to improve the situation for the worst off. We'll have to see. That would be my prediction, though, that there'll be something in the budget that will offset it.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Invest and Explain feature. Lisa, we've got a question here from a listener. I've seen gold prices have hit record highs and I'd like to invest but don't know how. What are my options?
Well, Lee, if I may say so, I prefer to invest in something when it's at a record low rather than when it's at a record high. But gold responds to geopolitical uncertainty about the dollar, so people are definitely turning to it for a store of value. Firstly, there's actually owning gold, physical gold, but there are problems with that with storage and insurance. And at Charles Stanley, we like physically backed exchange traded commodities because there's physical gold that's sitting in a vault, and that's how you access investing in gold. We would rather do that than a derivative, which can be confusing, and ultimately you question whether you can get to the gold itself. A couple of thoughts about gold. It is volatile. It goes up and down. It's a store of value, but it's not in itself a productive investment. It doesn't have interest or dividends or rent. It's just a store of value. So it can be useful in a portfolio, but we wouldn't have too much of it in a portfolio.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Following on from This Is Money's recent story about widows and widowers potentially missing out on inherited state pension, they've been deluged by reader stories. A number of them, like the one we're going to discuss in a minute, have been given incorrect information by Department for Work and Pensions staff. So Sir Steve Webb has written a Mythbuster column. Tanya, if you would just briefly remind us of the missing inherited state pension story.
Yes, this is separate from the state pension problems that we had a couple of years ago that Stephen, This Is Money uncovered. Those were an older group of pensioners. This is people who are widowed now, either their late spouse reached state pension age before 2016, April 2016, when there was a huge shakeup in the way the system works, or they actually died before then, that they died even younger than that. And you do get a bump up to your own state pension under some circumstances. And not everybody. It's, again, one of those very personal things that is based on, you know, your own record, your partner's record, what kind of job they were in, whether they were contracted out of that work pension scheme and so on. But if they do qualify, it can be between 50 and 100% of their second state pension, i.e. the top-up that used to exist to the basic state pension before 2016. And there was this old thing called graduated state pension as well, which was only in for a few years, quite a long time ago. But a lot of older people would have had a few years and there might be a few pence or pounds of that as well. And you could inherit half of that too under certain circumstances. So Steve started discovering a few cases where this hadn't been calculated properly or added when people were reaching, when widows and widowers were reaching state pension age now. So we highlighted one case, but there were more, and we put a call out for people to get in touch. We've had an absolutely huge response. A lot of people are using the tool that's on Steve's website. If you go to the story, which is still at the top of the pensions homepage, there's a link to the tool on Steve's company's website. They do it pro bono, it's free, and they do not keep your personal information. He has reassured me. So it is worth checking that out if you have been widowed and you think you might be in any of the groups that I've described. The reason, though, that Steve wrote this latest column was among the many, many messages he got from concerned people thinking they might be affected by this. He got a lot of reports of what DWP staff have been saying to people when they rang up. And I think he was just really concerned about the amount of wrong information that was being handed out to people, which was really quite misleading. And if they were told this and then were sent off and then didn't follow it up any further, then they could be losing out on state pension. And we could be looking at yet another underpayment scandal. We don't know yet. We're investigating more cases, but we don't know how far reaching it is yet. But the point of this article was really to debunk the myths that are being perpetuated, sadly, by the DWP staff themselves. And the one he highlighted for the lady who wrote in this week was, your late husband died too young, basically. He died before state pension age. That doesn't count. Other things being equal, you could still inherit. And that is one of the things that has been wrongly told to people.
And it's well worth reading this Mythbuster article. There's lots in there. But what have DWP said? I assume this is not nefarious actions on their staff giving people wrong information so they don't have to pay out. There must be some sort of errors along the way, but where have they crept in?
Well, we don't know why staff are giving out wrong information. I mean, I can only suppose that it is lack of training and lack of knowledge about this particular area. In terms, Georgie, of what the DWP said, I'll read out their quote that they provided to Steve's column. "We want to ensure pensioners receive all the support to which they're entitled and have a tool to help them understand what state pension they can inherit. Delays can occur to a customer's state pension award when not all the information we need is provided. In these cases, we will make a state pension award based on the customer's own national insurance record until we have the required information. Once we have all the necessary documentation, we will then revise the customer's claim as soon as possible."
Right. I fear this will rumble on, Tanya.
We're continuing to investigate and we'll keep people posted.
I have no doubts that you will. We are going to stick with pensions, though, so keep your pensions hat on for the time being. Have annuity deals peaked, Tanya? That's the question that you're asking. Interest rate cuts will likely diminish future offers. So what's happening to annuity rates? And just Personal Finance 101, how are they linked to interest rates?
Well, annuities are funded by government bonds, which are obviously affected by interest rates. So the rule of thumb is obviously when interest rates are higher, then providers can fund better deals. And that's reflected in the annuity rates that you get. We've already had one rate cut and we're expecting more. So the annuity rates have already come off a little bit. They're still looking relatively good value compared with where they were during the many, many years where interest rates were at rock bottom. that has really got people interested in annuities again, because they are used for us for a certain kind of pensioner when you want to fund retirement, and you can use them in tandem with keeping your pension invested. And if you play it correctly, they can work very well together. You can do things like buy a short-term annuity, which will, if you retire early, tide you over to your state pension kicks in. The benefit of an annuity is that it's guaranteed income until you die, as the state pension is. And so therefore, people often put them in the same category when they're planning what they're going to live on in retirement, how they're going to fund that income. So I don't think there's any reason to panic. Hargreaves Lansdown, which took a look at this and was quoted in a recent story we've done about this, say that the cutting cycle could be a lot slower than the hiking cycle when it comes to interest rates. And it's not a decision that you want to rush, because it is irreversible, unlike going into drawdown, in which case you could decide to buy an annuity at any point and make other arrangements with your finances. It is a contract you enter into. So once you've handed over the money, that's it. There are various protections that are built into annuities, though. You can, for instance, buy a guarantee period. It's often something like 5 years, so that if you died within that guarantee period, i.e. just after you bought the annuity, you wouldn't necessarily lose all the money. There would be something for your surviving relatives. And there's all sorts of different things you can bolt on to annuities. You can have an income for your surviving spouse, for example. You can have various inflation protections. Sometimes it's CPI related or RPI related. Sometimes it's just a set 3%. But we've only just come out of a period of high inflation, which I'm sure has concentrated people's minds about the downsides of buying an annuity, a level annuity with no inflation protection whatsoever. And I would add a cautionary note that usually when people write stories about annuities, they usually give the top rate, which is a level annuity, which a single life level annuity. So you need to be aware that if you're going to start building in all these protections, then that top rate is not going to be what you get.
All right, then. Thank you very much, Tanya. Finally, we have two dynamite Lee Boyce's word, ask the expert questions to go through. The first is about money, morals and friendship, and Mike Ashley. That was the first thing that came to my mind, Lee. So I was stoked when you're the author of the article made that mention. And the second one is about neighbourly disputes. Lee, take on the first. It's a toughie, this one, isn't it?
It is. Quickly before I do, can I just say that we live for this kind of thing on This Is Money. You know, our reader engagement, listener engagement, people getting in touch with, you know, their kind of money quibbles and stories and problems. You know, it's out the lifeblood.
We live for people's problems, Lee.
Well, we do. You know, kind of, a problem shared is a problem solved and all that. You know, we're always keen to get your sort of questions like this answered by, you know, genuine experts that kind of know what they're doing. And there's all sorts of things that we get. We couldn't possibly answer everything that we get emailed in, but sometimes some of them you just can't pass over, and you just kind of double take going again. That's a really good one. People are going to want to know what the answer to that is, because even though I would never do this or whatever, we've all got a friend that would probably do this first one, quite possibly, depending how bad they are managing their alcohol level. So I'll read out the question. It says, I have a financial question that I'm ashamed to even ask, but it really matters to me. Never be ashamed. Never be ashamed. Mm. Last week, I had a very drunken evening and lent my friend £3,000, which I don't remember doing. Apparently, when we were in the pub, he said he needed money to build his mum a wheelchair ramp for her home. And as I was so inebriated, I transferred him the money there and then. I only realised when I checked my bank balance the next day. The problem is that the money is most of my cash savings and I really need it back. He's currently refusing, saying I gave him the money fair and square and he'd already told his mum the good news. Where do I stand legally? That is tough.
I've got lots of questions about that you're so drunk you don't remember, but you can still transfer money across to someone's account, assuming that they must have already set that up, because honestly, I couldn't do that when I was that drunk.
It's a kind of a muscle memory type thing, isn't it? Like logging into your banking. You know, we've got so used to it, and that's the danger of having lots of this stuff at our fingertips. And then if you already had this person set up as a payee or whatever, it would take no time at all for this transfer to go through. Lots of, you know, especially blokes just egging each other on in a pub. You can see how these kind of scenarios can unfold. So listen, I mean, first of all, the kind of advice here is to really sort of push home with your friend that, look, this was kind of not, you know, kind of what I wanted to do, and please can you send the money back, like I'm really sorry to have mucked you around and all of that kind of thing. But it sounds like this isn't going to work in this case.
No.
And also the other question I would have is, how close a friend is it? Because if this was me and my best friend, like, there was absolutely no way A, that they would ever accept it, and B, if that had happened, he would just transfer it back straight away. So it depends on how close you are with this person. But in English law, a valid gift requires three things: the voluntary intention of the donor to give the gift to the receiver, the delivery of the gift to the receiver, and the acceptance of the gift by the receiver. All of those things are kind of ticked in this case. So it's quite shaky ground, because you could argue that you didn't give the money voluntarily because you were drunk. But technically, you did give the money freely and without duress. You weren't kind of forced, coerced into doing it. So anyway, Sam Barker, who took on this story, asked Kelly Tinkler, who is Keystone Law's litigation partner. And she mentioned the Mike Ashtree case, as you rightly pointed out just there. But basically, in short, this person might have a case if they're happy to take a legal route against a friend and B, have some sort of proof that they were drunk at the time. Now, I would say that probably, you know, £3,000 is a lot of money, and it's a lot of money to people. What's your friendship worth? You know, and then you kind of start getting legal costs and things involved. It's a real nightmare in my kind of viewpoint to sort of do that. The proof of your being drunk, basically, it depends who else was there at the time. You know, and you would need probably a few kind of people willing to say that you were drunk, but they might have been drunk as well. So it's kind of very, very illegal.
Yeah.
So the case of Mike Ashtree was that in 2017, he was alleged to have made a contract to provide a £15 million bonus to a contractor in the context of drinks at a bar. Now, Kelly says here, the judge concluded that while the intoxication was not definitive in this case, the informal setting and the jocular nature of the conversation meant that it was unlikely that the parties intended to create a contract. He also noted that the purpose of the meeting was not to discuss bonus arrangements. Now, the other thing I would say in this is, you know, there isn't a contract. And the one piece of information I think we're a little bit light in the question is, was this a kind of formal loan in terms of, yes, I'll give you the £3,000, but you need to pay me back £300 a month in the next 10 months, or, you know, something along those lines. That isn't clear. And it's not, if you haven't outlined how this person's going to pay the money back, it's going to be very difficult to claw this money back without a friendship being completely blown up. And B, going down the legal route. So it's interesting, and keep the interesting questions coming, you know, and obviously there's a more in-depth answer to this on the website, but that's the nuts and bolts of it. And basically, we say don't drink and drive, but definitely don't drink and transfer, or I don't know, it must be a catchier thing than that. I would probably just switch your phone off or uninstall your banking app when you're done.
People pay with their phones now, Lee. It's so difficult, isn't it?
They do. You know me, Georgia, I'm old school.
Cash savings in a separate.
I like taking. Yeah. That's why I just take my wallet out with a set amount of money to go to the pub.
It's a good idea, Lee.
Yeah, listen, I live and learn. Not that I've ever transferred £3,000 or £15 million to anyone, but you know,
I mean, I might have promised £15 million to someone when I was inebriated, but they're pretty confident that they wouldn't have believed me. Tanya, we have a second one, though, don't we? A second dynamite question about student housing, or sort of.
Yes, this is, you can understand the concern of this person who has just found out that their next door neighbour is going to convert their home to a house of multiple occupation, an HMO, for six people and let it out to students. Now, this might be absolutely fine. Students are there to study, and quite a lot of them will be, you know, getting on with their work and going to lectures and not causing anyone any trouble. On the other hand, you can kind of see that at weekends, evenings, they might be partying at times when you want to go to sleep because you've got work the next day when they haven't. So you can understand why this would cause concern, and they want to know if there's anything they can do to stop it. We got several experts to answer this. There is a possibility of being able to put a stop to it, but it depends on a number of factors. Over six people, you'd have to get planning permission unless it's in something that's called an Article 4 area. So the first thing you need to do, since this is six people, would be to check up with your local council what the rules are. Is this person going to have to get planning permission to do this conversion and start letting it out? And that's really your starting point. If they have to get planning permission, then there's various things that you can argue about. Overcrowding, that's to do with high density. There's parking. Is there enough parking there? You can talk about the community cohesion, which is more about, is this a quiet residential area with not many student houses there? And is this really going to sort of change the nature of the community, especially if there end up being lots of other student houses suddenly springing up all around an area that didn't have them before? And they also suggest going to the land registry and trying to find out about your neighbour's title deeds, whether there's any covenants against this. Basically, that's another avenue. But as often with these things with neighbour disputes, and we get lots and lots of questions, and often they're about neighbour disputes. One of the first things that the experts always say is just go and talk to your neighbour, have a conversation before you do anything else about it. And what they're suggesting in this case is try and find out who they're going to let it to. I mean, there's students and students. Basically, if they've got a very nice property and they're letting out to a certain, you know, theology students at the nearby theology college, then that's maybe a slightly different scenario. And also how it's going to be managed. And if there is a problem that emerges, can they come and complain to this person? Try and get a feel, I suppose, for how proactive this neighbour is going to be. If you say, look, there's music and shouting going on from 8 o'clock in the evening until 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, five nights a week, and I can't take it anymore. How responsive are they going to be to that in terms of clamping down? And I suppose also the kind of rules they're going to set for the house, whether they're going to tell these students this is a residential neighbourhood and you really need to turn the music off by midnight or whatever the rules are. And you can often, I think, get a feel for the person and how responsible they're going to be. Neighbours are all different, and there might be some neighbours who are going to be incredibly reassuring in that scenario. So come to me. The moment you have a problem, come to me. I will talk to the students and sort it out, and be really keen to make sure that they're not, you know, disturbing the neighbourhood with what they're doing here.
I was just shocked reading this article at how few students and people between 18 to 24 drink. I know I certainly wouldn't have wanted to live near me when I was a student, that's for sure. But Lee, things are different now. Students are more sensible than we were.
Yeah, I mean, you say sensible, but you kind of, you have that sense of freedom when you're a university student that you've never had before, where you can go and do just like, and that age of your life is for staying up late, pulling all nighters, doing daft things. You know, it's kind of part of your kind of right as a student, and kind of, you know, I think though that basically you don't want to be living next to sort of like the equivalent of like the young ones, or like, you know, someone that's basically going to cause a complete nuisance having parties all the time. And having been a university student from the ages of 18 and 21, that did definitely not fall into the category of people that didn't drink. I mean, in this story, the YouGov survey said 44% of 18 to 24 year olds consider themselves an occasional regular drinker. But I mean, to be fair, when I think these YouGov surveys get asked, I think lots of people undercook what they actually do. But this one landed in the inbox and I saw it and my eyebrows instantly raised. I thought, God, can you imagine that you've been living quite a peaceful life somewhere, and then all of a sudden six students are sort of rock up next door, and it only takes one of those students to do something, you know, kind of annoying all the time, playing loud music or doing stuff that you just kind of, even past midnight, you know, we're getting older, Georgie. If someone keeps me up past midnight these days, I get incredibly cross. And if your walls are paper thin and you can hear everything going on next door, I mean, I dread to think what, you know, if you had paper thin walls and lived next door to me at university, you know, you wouldn't have wanted to do it. Okay, there was a little bit of partying, not huge amounts. Mainly it just involved me sitting around with my mates playing Football Manager till about 5 a.m. cheering goals as they went in and all that kind of stuff. But I think that, you know, this is why student accommodation really exists, and basically lots of student housing should be sort of clubbed together rather than, you know, kind of sticking them into sort of family orientated properties or into flats that are kind of not quite geared up for it. But really, you don't have much of a leg to stand on, because there's a shortage of homes, there's a shortage of people where to live. Student accommodation has become very expensive. I mean, it was expensive when I went to uni. In fact, the accommodation was more expensive than the course, because I was living in London. And, you know, it's all those things to sort of weigh up. You like to think, again, I think also it does depend. I don't know whereabouts in the country this person was, but, you know, if you're at a very near a prestigious university, you like to think it really is people that are kind of there to study. If it's one that's maybe at the bottom of those kind of university rankings, people are just there basically for a good time, then you might be in for some very sleepless nights. And I also think that the last bit I touch on this is what it does for your future house value. You know, I don't know if you have to declare the house next door is an HMO or anything like that, but, you know, if the area starts getting a bit scraggy and your next door neighbours, it all gets overgrown, and, you know, I'm putting students in a bad light here, because not all students are like this, but, you know, stereotypical student where you think, you know, they might not look after the property as well as a homeowner might, you can totally understand why someone would get kind of scared by this. But yeah, look, keep these questions coming in, because, as I say, lifeblood of this is money, and we love reading them and we love getting the answers.
Quite, as Lee says, keep your problems coming. Right, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee?
Yeah, you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can also tweet us @thisismoney, and you can comment in the article in which this lives.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.